I wanted to ask about the halacha, the change we switched from saying bracha to the same topic on bracha on December 4th or 5th. Why do we pay such a secular candidate as opposed to the church?
Yeah, the question that was asked was about the one part of our Siddur that seems to be based on a secular date, and that is the switching from the same bracha to the same Talmud Matar in Chutz Laaretz, not in Eretz Yisrael, is based on a secular date, December 5th or December 4th. Well, let me explain. The Mishnah Maseches Tainis says, La Halacha at least, that we start asking for rain the 7th of Mar Cheshvan in Eretz Yisrael, which is 2 weeks after Sukkot. Excuse me a second. And that's based on the idea that we don't want to ask for rain till everybody in Eretz Yisrael who came to Yerushalayim got back home, that they shouldn't be stuck in the rain traveling on the roads. So the 7th of Mar Cheshvan is 2 weeks after Sukkot. But the Gemara says that is only true in Eretz Yisrael where people are Ole Regel. But in Bavel, what should the Zman be? So the Zman that is given is you should ask for rain 60 days after the equinox. The equinox is the where the day and the night is equal of the fall equinox. Now, putting aside that modern calculations are different, but the way the Gemara calculates the equinox is based on the position of the sun, or at least the position of the earth vis-a-vis the sun. That's the seasons, right? After the fall equinox, the nights get longer and longer and longer and longer and longer till you hit the winter solstice. Then the days get longer and longer and longer till you hit the spring equinox, etc. So 60 days from the fall equinox happens to be, under an older Julian calendar, it happens to be December 4th. Now, it's not quite accurate today, but this is Chazal's point. 60 days after the Tekufa of the fall, so it's called Tekufas Tishrei. And the reason that is so is that in Bavel, that is when the rainy season began. The rainy season began around December 4th or the like. Now, there is a very, very big machlokas that happens to be Bavel. That wouldn't be the rainy season for the United States, for Australia, for different countries of Europe. So indeed, there is a machlokas rishonim. Some rishonim say that the rule of 60 days after Tekufa is only a din in Bavel, so if anyone is going to Iraq, that's what they would follow. But in every other country where the Chachamim didn't make a special rule, you should either follow Eretz Yisrael, which is Zion Mar Cheshvan, or you figure out what is the rainy season of each individual country. So that's a very, very good svara. But lahalacha, we paskin, that since the Chachamim only give us two periods, the Eretz Yisrael period and the Bavel period, so the Chachamim were mesakein, everything that is not Eretz Yisrael should follow the halacha of Bavel. That's really a low plug, but you are correct. It is a very good question. And that is why b'di'evit, in point of fact, in deference to the shitas that say every country outside of Bavel should follow Eretz Yisrael, if b'di'evit, between Zion Cheshvan and December 4th, you said, v'sein talu matra, you asked for rain before that date of December 4th, b'di'evit, you are yotzei shmona esrei, because some shitas would say that that is the appropriate time. But it is a bit of an anomaly.
Granted that there's a lot of different ways of understanding what the Mabul was, and understanding the time like that, how long on a clock the 6 days of creation took. There's a lot of different ways of understanding that. But how do we tie that indigenous peoples and indigenous animals got to places like Australia and places that are not accessible by land?
Well,
because there was a Mabul which wiped everything out. And then all of a sudden there's people, and we don't necessarily hold by the whole Pangaea thing. I mean, I don't see any Torah sources for that. So,
well, other than the timeline, which would be a problem, I mean, there's nothing in the Torah that is against the concept that different land masses may have been connected by land bridges.
But the timeline is a problem. It would take
timeline is a problem. The problem is how do you reconcile that as well? But again, I mean, let me ask you, Bichlal. I guess that's the question you're asking. Given the fact that Noach was here, yeah. So one possibility is that when we say the Mabul destroyed the world, it destroyed the world that was inhabited by human beings. Meaning to say, there may have been corners of the world in which there were no Bnei Adam; there were only animals. That it could be HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't destroy, because the tachlis of Bria was mankind. Mankind was niskalkel, and therefore Hashem decreed that mankind has to be eradicated. And since the animals existed only for man, so if you destroy man, you destroy the animals. But in any makam where there may not have been man at all, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have left for whatever the tachlis is. So that is a possibility. I know it sounds a little off the beaten track to say that the Mabul was not worldwide. I think it is Pashut from the Torah itself that every human being was destroyed except for Noach and his children. But it's not necessarily so rachak to say that in Australia or whatever it is, if there were no people then, so that was left. I mean, that might be.
What about indigenous Australians and people who supposedly were there for the entire history of the continent?
Well, you know, we don't necessarily have to accept their characterization as indigenous. Indigenous could just mean they were there a long time, but it's lav dafka that they predated the Mabul or whatever it is, that somehow after the Dor HaFlaga, people split off and people wound off there as well. So that already, I think, there's less of a chiyuv to accept the way it is described. I mean, there are other mahalchim that are much more problematical, and some say they're kfira, and some say they're within the realm of acceptability, and that is, could there be human beings who are not descended from Adam, that are not B'Tselem Elokim? You know, some want to suggest, in terms of the age of man, that there may have been Homo sapien creatures who predated Adam. And when we say that man is only 5,776 years old, we mean the man with the Tselem Elokim and the divine soul. And there may be indigenous Homo sapien creatures who have the intelligence on some level of man, but don't have that spark of divinity. But again, some would say that you know, that's not a permitted thought. Some would say it is a permitted thought. But I think we don't have to go that far to answer that question. We could just say that there's no, you know, every all life started here, and whatever is somewhere else came there later at some point. Yeah.
There's an Mizrach Deraisa to make images of sun and stars and the moon. How far can we go on as far as drawing goes? Like for children, for example, and in general, how far can a person go?
Yeah, this is a very, very complicated sugya, actually. It's an underlearned and an underdeveloped sugya, because you read the Gemara, and it seems to be that many things are much more usser than we commonly do. But number one, many, many shitas do permit two-dimensional drawings, and they say the whole prohibition is three-dimensional sculpture. Number two, some Rishayim say that even on a sculpture, it is only if it's a realistic depiction and not if it's clearly like a childlike drawing. And number three, Rav Avadja has a whole mahalach about dolls and other things, that at a time when none of those things are used by any society as idolatry, right, the whole issue is that even if you're not doing it for Avodah Zarah, since these were things that were used for Avodah Zarah, so there's a prohibition to make them and even to own them, but where it's a davar barur that nobody uses them for Avodah Zarah, there is a makom to be makel. So we have two-dimension versus three-dimension. We have the childlike reproduction versus a realistic reproduction. And we have the fact that these things are not used for idolatry. So Lamaisa, we are fairly makel for drawing the sun and the moon, the stars, even human faces and the like. So that would be the basis of it. Now, you know the story. There is a story that the Chafetz Chaim's last surviving child, Rebbetzin Zaks, she once told the story. She once gave an interview, very interesting, of what it was like to be raised by the Chafetz Chaim. She was a Bas Sikunim. She was born when the Chafetz Chaim was already a very old man, from the Chafetz Chaim's second wife. So she says that it was sometimes tough. He says he was not a disciplinarian at all. He was a very, very gentle and kind father, but he insisted on Midas Tovas. So one time he wanted her to check 100 sets of Mishneh Berurah just to see if there were blank pages. They came from the printer, and he didn't want to sell them if there were any blank pages. So he asked her to check 10 sets of Mishneh Berurah. That would be 60 volumes. So she was going out to play. I don't know where in Radin you went out to play, but she was going out to play, and she said, "Can't do it now. But, you know, when I get back, I'll do 100 sets, but not now." So she runs out. So she gets back, and there are 100 sets of Mishneh Berurah on the table. That's 600 volumes. So she says, "Abba, you gave me 10 before. Why 100? He says, "You can't lie. You say something, you have to fulfill exactly the word that you say. Emes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu hates checking." So she says she had to check 600 volumes of Mishneh Berurah. But the story I'm bringing is that once somebody gave her a doll, and she was so excited, she went to show her Abba the doll, and the Chafetz Chaim said, "I just need to take the doll for a moment." He took the doll, he took a knife, and he cut off the nose. He says, "Now you can play with it." So, "Abba, what did you do?" No. So the Chafetz Chaim was machmir, that he felt that it was a human like face. But Lamaisa Ravadia has a whole tshuva that we are mekel on dolls for that reason. Yeah.
You mentioned last week that Islam is essentially an enemy that we can't, that doesn't compromise politically nor militarily.
Yeah.
And we also mentioned last week Amalek, that has a very similar to behavior that the Midrash brings, that which they would jump in the water, jump in a hot bowl of water in order to just reduce it. I mean, they have these bizarre attitudes or behaviors that really based in terrorism, just instilling fear and doing it without any limits. Now, is Amalek just a nation, or can it really be an ideology, and then can we put a name to or label the Amalek to any certain nation right now?
So there are two different things to keep in mind. It all depends in which context you're asking the question. The mitzvah of the Torah to physically murder, eradicate Amalek, destroy them, only applies to a very specific genealogical nation, and we're not really clear who that is. So halachically, you know, there's no obligation and there's a prohibition just to kill somebody because they represent a Molochite ideology. However, in a spiritual sense, it is absolutely the case that Amalek is not just a person or a collection of people. It does represent a certain ideology. And it's the ideology of Amalek, interestingly enough, although you would connect it with fanaticism, Amalek is really a fanatical moral relativism and skepticism, meaning Amalek is fanatical about the idea that there are no absolute values. That's why, indeed, one would have to be ma'ayin whether Islamic fundamentalism is truly Amalek. It has connections to Amalek, and the fanaticism and the hatred of Jews emanates from Amalek, but it may not be a pure Amalekite ideology. Amalekite represents the coldness of the heart and the skepticism that there's anything emes. That's why the Svarim tell us the gematria of Amalek is hasafik. Everything is a question. Everything is open to doubt. Meaning, if you believe in something strongly, that already is not necessarily Amalek. So in many, many ways it's confusing, because last week I was trying to connect Islamic fundamentalism to Amalek. But in many ways, it is the decadism of the West, or decadence of the West, that is very much connected to Amalek. The idea that nothing matters, nothing makes a difference. And Amalek is so fanatical to the idea that nothing makes a difference that it becomes a religious ideology that nothing makes a difference. Maybe this is a bit of rhetorical overkill, but one of the Rebbeim here once wrote a column for the Or Sameach newsletter trying to make the argument that the Simpsons represents Amalek. Again, I don't want to go that far necessarily, but this is the concept of Amalek is called Leitzonus. Leitzonus is nothing is important in life. And that itself can become a fanatical religion. So it's very, very complicated, because in a way, you wouldn't associate that with Islamic fundamentalism. But in a sense, it's connected to that in the sense that life itself doesn't matter. So that is what Amalek is. So Amalek is a very unusual combination of a fanatical devotion to the idea that nothing matters.
We have the Ten Commandments, and the do not steal in the Ten Commandments. Someone told me the other day that that only means kidnapping.
Yes.
Why the distinction? It seems quite wrong to be there.
No, so it's a very good point. Rashi brings from the Medrash that the way you interpret verses has to be in the context of everything before. Now, before it says don't steal, it says don't murder and don't commit adultery. Now, those are sins for which you get capital punishment, murder and adultery. So Chazal Darshan, just like murder and adultery are capital crimes, then not stealing must also be a capital crime, and kidnapping is a capital crime. Stealing money is not a capital crime. You just pay double. And therefore, based on one of the 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael, that says, Davar halameid mi'in yano, that you interpret verses based on their context, lo signov is kidnapping. Now, that doesn't mean the Torah says you're allowed to steal money. We have other verses in Sefer Vayikra that say lo signovo, etc. But in the Ten Commandments, it refers to kidnapping.
So they're just capital crimes in the Ten Commandments.
Though. That's correct. That's the basic idea, that the Ten Commandments are the biggies, so to speak, and we only encompass the ones that you're chayav misa for.
This is why is kidnapping the only type of stealing that you would get there?
Well, I think that makes sense. I mean, lahavdil, even in a secular society, kidnapping is sometimes a capital crime. Stealing a person is much more serious than just taking money. You know, it could create psychological trauma to a person that could destroy his own life. So that is a more chomer crime. If you remember, Chazal actually say, do you remember the 10 martyrs that were killed? We read about on Tisha B'Av on Yom Kippur. So according to the slicha that we say, they were killed as the punishment for Mechiras Yosef by the 10 tribes. That hundreds and hundreds of years later, there was a heavenly decree that the great sages would die as an atonement for Mechiras Yosef, which was kidnapping. Taking a person and selling him into slavery is the kidnapping the Torah is talking about.
So I asked you this morning, but when we are sitting down and looking at the Daf Gemara, can you walk us through a little bit of the process of how we got to exactly what we're looking at?
Well, that is a long question, but let me just correct a misimpression some people have. Obviously, the Gemara is the oral Torah, which was oral for many, many years until there was a risk of it being forgotten, and then it was written down. But it's called the oral law because it was given to Moshe B'Sinai, but was not written down. So some people understand that to mean that every single word of the Mishnah or the Gemara was given by Hashem to Moshe and simply handed down, and the Gemara is just a written record of things that were directly told to Moshe. Now that cannot be the case. That would be a very absurd thing, because the Gemara has historical personages, whether it's Abaye, Rava, Hillel, and Shammai, and they are talking to each other, and Abaye says something, and Rava asks a question, and Abaye gives an answer, or vice versa. Now, to simply say they're reading off a script that was given to Moshe at Sinai, it really is nonsensical, meaning to say, okay, Abaye, these are the lines that Hashem said you're supposed to say at this point, and you, Rava, you say these lines, and be sure to stand here, etc. Obviously, that's not what's going on. What is going on with Abaye and Rava is the same thing that goes on with you guys during morning Seder. Now, obviously, it's not the same level. Obviously, the level is, well, I don't want to say about you, but it wouldn't be the same level, but it's the same process. When you have a kasha, it's not like God told you, okay, this is what you're supposed to tell your chavrusa, and chavrusa, this is what you say back. Rather, we're using our mind. Abaye and Rava were using their minds, and they were using their words, and they were using their ideas. So in what way do I say it was given to Moshe B'Sinai? So you have to understand, the nature of the oral law is Hashem gave Moshe fundamental principles of interpretation. Whether it's the 13 principles of interpretation, whether it's basic laws explaining what tefillin is and the like, but how you apply those laws to new situations. That was not given by Hashem to Moshe. That was left to the Chachamim to take the fundamental principles of the oral law and apply them through logic and reasoning. Hashem wanted the Chachmei Yisrael to be actively involved. So when we say, and this happens even today, you know, when electricity got invented or discovered or harnessed, whatever word you want to use, so there's immediately a question, are you allowed to turn on electricity on Shabbos or Yom Tov? Is electricity called fire? And people debated. Now there's a consensus, but in the 19th century, it was not so much. People debated, is electricity fire? Now, a religious person might say, well, what did Hashem tell Moshe? Did Hashem tell Moshe electricity is fire or not? What did Hashem tell Moshe about microwave cooking? So I would suggest to you that Hashem said nothing about it. Hashem gave Moshe the prohibitions of fire and the definition of fire. But how that's going to play out with new technology was left to the sages of every generation who are authorized by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to interpret the Torah. So really, the Gemara is a record of the debates of hundreds and hundreds of years of Chachamim grappling with the principles of the Torah in order to apply them to new situations, different situations, etc. So the Torah, not the Torah, the oral law is both a product of divinity and a product of human interaction and creativity. And Hashem wanted to give the Torah that way because Hashem wanted Klal Yisrael to be actively involved in the creation of the Torah. I give this mashal many times, so forgive me if you heard it before, but I give the mashal of making a cake. If you wanted to make a cake for your child, the best way to make it is when the child is in kindergarten and gone or asleep. But if you want to show your love for the child, you make the cake with the child. Now the cake that you make with your child is going to be much less perfect than the cake you would make by yourself. Be lumpy, underbaked, overbaked, burnt. But the love is in the relationship. If Hashem would have given us the answer to every single question, you wouldn't need a Gemara. You would just have a very large Kitzur Shulchan Aruch that says, this is the answer. Now in some ways, that would be great. No machlokas, no ambiguity, no need to look at hava aminas and maskanas, just the bottom line, just the facts, just the answer. But Hashem said, I'm not going to let you off so easily. I want you to be my partner in bringing my truth into the world. And therefore I'm going to give you the raw materials, and you, by human debate, will reconstruct all of this. That's what the oral law actually means. It is dynamic, it is interactive, it is creative. And that is why we have the phenomenon that even when the Chachamim get it objectively wrong, it becomes Hashem's will. That's the din of Lo B'Shamayim. The sages come to a conclusion. Hashem says, that's wrong, but I'm going to go with your answer anyway. Because it becomes the will of Hashem. The Torah is right that the Chachamim are koveya the halacha. So essentially, the Gemara is the record of the greatest sages of Am Yisrael grappling with eternal truth and applying eternal truth to the ever-changing situations of life. Torah is eternal, but life changes all the time. Life changes. There are new things that happen, new events, new technologies, new questions, new forms of human deception and lying. You know, ever think about how much of, you know, the Baal Tanya talks about this. How much of our Torah learning are analyzing liars and cheats and frauds? I mean, Cheskes Habatzim, one of the big Yesodistic Aprakim of Shas. If everybody was honest, we could just rip out that perek and get rid of it. Because what is it about? People claiming they bought land when they don't have the proof. Well, in a world of honesty, if I sold you the property, I would say, sure, take it. In a world of honesty, if you didn't buy the property, you would say, not mine. But what is Cheskes Habatim? What do you do when somebody's lying? Who do you believe? What proof do you need? Now, the Baal HaTanya writes, you might think, all of that is a contradiction to holiness. We shouldn't be learning about liars and cheats and frauds. We should be learning about, you know, honest people and good people. But the answer is, no, that's what God says. God says, I want you to bring the light of divinity even into the darkest, murkiest situations. Bring godliness even into the marketplace of fraud and cheating. And that's why we spend so much time. In fact, it's even brought down that this might be one of the reasons why women are either forbidden or discouraged. I want to be careful. I don't want to talk about an isser. To learn a lot of Gemara. And the reason that is so, it is said that women's emunah in Hashem is of a very pure faith. And for them to be overly exposed to the world of cheating and thievery and ramos would take away some of the purity of our emunah. Mashain came the male, it is said, their entree to emunah is through their analytic understanding of things. And therefore they try to analyze, and that brings them to God, as opposed to the emunah of the heart, in which Gemara might actually injure on some level, because the Gemara goes through kind of the lowest levels of society and the like. So I'm not sure. I there's probably a partial answer, as I indicated with our other group. With the first year group, I'll go over it more biarichas. But I think the one thing I wanted to emphasize is the notion that every word of the Gemara, word for word, was given to Moshe B'Sinai is not true. And it's an amazing thing. I still hear a lot of guys in Or Sameach well, we know that every, I mean, not even as a question, you just say, well, we know, of course, that every word of the Mishnah was given by Hashem to Moshe. Well, is that true? When it says, Rabbi Meir says this and Rav Yehuda says this, was that given to Moshe? That Rav Yehuda will say this? Did Rav Yehuda have free choice to take his position? If it was already said to Moshe B'Sinai, that is Rav Yehuda's position, was he born with that position? So one has to understand that Torah Shebaal Peh is a much more sophisticated, deeper, and dynamic idea than simply a ton of information that was passed down. Yeah.
For people who didn't give like Meister their whole lives, basically like Moshe Shiloh or some people, like Meister is on like any money that they made. And then they chuva in their 20s or something, is there a way to make up for it?
Yeah, generally speaking, the way Meiser works, since Me'ikir Hadin, we paskin that Meiser, it's a machlokas, there are three opinions. Is Meiser a Doraisa obligation? Is it a Drabanan obligation? Is it a Minhag obligation? Which is an obligation. We paskin Me'ikir Hadin that Meiser is not a Derabanan or Doraisa. Meiser is a Minhag. And because it is a Minhag, the general Mahalech is that you're only Mechuyev from the point that you've now started doing it, meaning you are not Mechuyev to make up back years. If that would be the case, right, the Meiser would be quite big. And that you simply basically say that from now on I will give 10% of my income for tzedakah, with the exception that if you have any type of tangible, so for example, let's say I start wanting to give Meiser when I'm 25, so 10% of any income that comes in I'll take off Meiser, but then you do have to take off 10% of any existing assets. So if you have a savings account of $10,000 that you still have, you will give $1,000 of that to Meiser, securities account, things like that. So what you have is your principal. You take off Meiser, but you don't have to recalculate past years.
Yeah. Are you able to say Kaddish for somebody who's cremated or buried in a non-Jewish cemetery? And does it matter if they're married to a non-Jew in their life or not?
Yeah, it's a difficult, tragic issue. Unfortunately, most of us have either family members or friends or parents of friends who are in one of those situations or both of those situations. Cremation is unfortunately an increasingly common option today. Part of it is, you know, it's expensive to get buried in the ground, and cremation is much cheaper, and unfortunately, for money, people will cut a lot of corners. Now, here, there's a very interesting distinction between the law in the books and how it's applied. As far as the Shulchan Aruch is concerned, if a person was cremated, I don't mean, of course, in the concentration camps, I'm talking about voluntary cremation. So a person, we do not sit Shiva for the person, we do not recite Kaddish for the person, we do not mourn for the person at all. The halacha is very, very straight, that this is a rejection of God, and one does not give any honor to that person. However, the halacha in this area, as it is in many other areas, takes cognizance of the fact that people who didn't have a background in Judaism, people who didn't know better, people who are conditioned by society, fall into the category of Tinok Shenishba, which means the captive baby, the baby that was raised not knowing anything differently. So as a result, although we still do not sit Shiva for them, but we do say Kaddish, we learn Mishnayos for them, we try to do things that will elevate their neshama, and that God should forgive the sin that took place. So as a bottom line, we do recite Kaddish for cremations, and we do learn Mishnah, although we do not sit Shiva for the person. And as I say, it's brought down in such a case like that you actually might say Kaddish for 12 months. Because the reason we don't say Kaddish for 12 months is because even the biggest Russia only suffers for 12 months. We don't want to imply that a loved one is a 12-month person. But if someone has committed a sin for which they may need the 12 months or more, so Kaddish is actually recited for 12 months. A very similar development, although not for the same reason, applies to suicides. God forbid, the halacha is that a suicide, we don't say Kaddish, we don't mourn, but there's a catch-22. This is only if the suicide was premeditated and was not a result of great trauma and depression. But when it was a result of great depression, we say the person was not acting in their right mind. But we then go backwards and say, well, nobody will commit suicide unless they are suffering severe depression. So practically speaking, most of the time we do recite Kaddish for suicides.
Can you go into some of the halakhic ramifications of hypothetical human and animal cloning?
Yeah. Just to be sure that okay, this would all again be a whole shiur on its own. Just to be sure people understand what cloning is, the fancier term for cloning is somatic cell nuclear transfer, SCNT. So that's one of, if you want to impress somebody, that's what you would call it. Essentially, we know, of course, that normally life is created when a sperm unites with an egg, and you have fertilization, and then you have a blastocyst, and then as it divides, you eventually have life, human life, animal life. Fertilization can be inside of a woman's body, which is normal, or it could be in vitro fertilization in a petri dish and then be transferred. But the common denominator is that 50% of the genetic material comes from the sperm, and 50% of the genetic material comes from the egg. And when there's a fusion, we have the genetic entity that will be alive. Now, what cloning does is, cloning is a technology, it does not occur naturally in nature, in which all of the genetic components comes from one source. Now, how does that work? You take an egg, you strip out the nucleus of the egg, remove the DNA of the egg, except for a mitochondrial, but you remove the DNA of the egg, and you put in a completed cell from a male factor, meaning a skin cell, it could be a tongue cell, whatever it would be, and it was found that somehow the insertion of that male somatic cell, complete cell, will somehow be taken as if there was a union of the male and the female, and then the egg will start splitting. And if you, or as an embryo, and then you put the embryo in a womb, and 9 months later, out pops a kid. But that kid is a 100% genetic copy, it's like an identical twin, of the source of the DNA. Meaning that kid is not a result of the fusion of chromosomes from an egg and a sperm, but it came totally from the somatic cell. So in effect, if I were to clone myself, although I would need an egg and a woman to carry that clone, right? You don't just walk into a copy shop and walk out with a copy of yourself. I mean, it would be a newborn baby, but that newborn baby would be my identical twin, born from a different womb, and, you know, 50 years different. I'm looking at my twin. So that's what cloning basically is. Now, why? What is the advantage of cloning? Well, number one, cloning, theoretically, could be used for infertility. Imagine a Holocaust survivor who is the last member of his family, and let's imagine he's even been castrated. Can't even have physical intercourse. When he dies, there's nobody left. Now, how can he and his wife continue the line? Now, they could adopt a child, but let's say he very much wants some type of genetic child. Well, cloning can be a way that he and his wife can have a child. Now, genetically, it would be his child, but it would come out of her womb after 9 months. So that's the closest possible thing you could get to an actual physical child that was born from their union, right? That's cloning. So halakhically, there are a lot of issues. One issue, of course, is does a clone have a neshama? Since the clone was not created through the union of Zachar and Nekeva. But here, those who write about cloning, we don't really have so many psukim about it, they say that a clone is not a golem. A golem is an artificial person that is created through Sefer Yetzirah. A golem does not have the koach of speech, and a golem does not have internal organs. If you took a knife and you stuck it in a golem, there'd be dirt in the middle. Here, l'chaira, there is a neshama. I mean, we're assuming, we don't know yet, a clone could talk. A clone would have internal organs. And most importantly, a clone is born from a woman. You see, what defines a human being is he who is born. What would we use the word? Yalud isha. So since a clone is born from a human being, now when we have artificial wombs, that'll be another question, but at least right now, a clone would be a human being. But are you allowed to do it? So one question is he human? Answer, probably yes. Does he have a divine soul? Probably yes, although how do we test that? Are you allowed to do cloning? So here we have a lot of shilas, you know. When they cloned the first sheep, Dali, the sheep, so they had to do 250 attempts before a sheep was born. And until that point, there were many genetic monsters that were created, many, many birth defects. So there's going to be a general halacha. Are you allowed to engage in technologies that have an extraordinarily high rate of serious birth defects? Now granted, over time there's a learning curve where things get corrected. But l'chatchila, are you allowed to create children that are going to be misshapen, deformed, retarded, and the like? That may be a self-correcting problem if people are violating the Torah, but at least l'chatchila you have that problem. But another series of issues. Oh yeah, and as you mentioned, another thing about cloning. And that is, since cloning is taking the somatic cell of an older person, the question is, how old is a clone? And this is a significant point. If I clone myself by taking DNA from my arm, from my skin, scientists have concluded that a clone will be born 50, 60 years old. The baby will be born an old man. And that has repercussions regarding health and the like. Because this DNA has already gone through 50, 60 years and the like. But let me mention one other nekuda. Assuming a clone is a human being, assuming a clone has a divine soul, assuming cloning is even permitted for a good purpose like pru or vu, let's assume all of that. What is my relationship to my clone? Is my clone my son? Or is my clone my brother? Because after all, it's true that he came from my DNA, but my DNA is in itself a combination of my father and my mother. And if the clone is my identical twin, then the clone who looks like my son is in reality my brother. Now this can create very bizarre consequences. Let's imagine a person dies and has no other children but a clone of himself. Now if his clone is his child, then his wife does not need yibam or chalitza. She could marry. But if the clone is not my child, the clone is my brother, it turns out that there's a chiyuv of yibam. And not only that, but the person that the clone is going to be miyaben is the one that we would think is his mother, because it's not really his mother. His mother is my mother. His real mother is my mother. And this is just the one out of whose womb he emerged. So you may have a bizarre scenario where a clone would have to be miyaben the woman that most of us would regard as his mother. So that's going to be some difficult issues. Yeah.
I have a distant relative who grew up a girl and is now Shane and has a beard. I don't know. I haven't seen this person in a long time, and I probably won't for a while. But what does it come down to? When halachically, obviously, I probably shouldn't touch this person. But what about the other way?
I'm sorry. Are you saying the person is from them?
No.
Maybe? Oh no. Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, things are so bizarre. You know, it's interesting that these types of perversities have no. You know, just a few years ago, we were debating and arguing about gay marriage. But now, you know, gay marriage is so makubal, the Supreme Court said, you know, that's not even a question anymore. That's a dover pashut, that's fine and dandy and wonderful. But now we have the very murky and dark world of transgenderism, and things have gone beyond that as well. There was recently a woman who changed to a man, but he didn't want to lose their ability to carry a baby. So he delivered a baby as a man, and the hospital room says, I am a he, and my giving birth to a baby in no way negates my male identity. So you need a whole sefer. In fact, there is a sefer, by the way. You need a whole sefer on the issues of transgenderism. Let me just say like this. I'm going to give you two basic shitas, just so you'll have some basic shitas. There is the shita of Rav Moshe Feinstein and most poskim. Most poskim say halacha does not recognize the mitzias called sex changes. There is no such thing as gender assignment, at least unless you were a hermaphrodite. But if you were a definitive male, even if you undergo surgery so you look like a female, and even inside you are a female, or vice versa, you are what you were born with. So most poskim say a woman who becomes a man is in fact a woman and not a man. However, the exception is the Tzitz Eliezer. Rav Voldenberg actually says, although one is not allowed to effect a sexual change, once the change is done, the Torah recognizes a new gender identity. So that would mean, according to Rev Voldenberg, if a woman underwent treatment to be a man, Rev Voldenberg would regard her as a man, and therefore you like Rev Voldenberg, you would have no problem at all with Yichud and Negiah. Now, the question is, according to Rev Moshe, that the woman who changes into a man is still a woman. What exactly would it be? The Pashtish, you would be Machmir, but some take the position that since all of these Yisurim are based on the Yisurim of Yichud and Negiah are based on sexual attraction, when externally there could not be sexual attraction anymore, so they would matur it. So there is a makam to be makel, even like Rav Moshe and like Rav Voldenberg for sure.
But what about Maris Ayin? There's a man who becomes a woman. And they come give you a big hug. First of all, there's a lot of reasons I wouldn't want to have
yes,
a hug.
Yes, that's for sure. If a man becomes a woman, that's the other way. So even like Rav Moshe, who says the person is still a man, there would be Marasayan, absolutely, absolutely. So you wouldn't be allowed to do that. Like Rav Waldenberg, it would be Usher Meikir Adin, because the person is a woman now.
Right.
And like Rav Moshe, it would be Usher because of Marasayan. That is correct. That is correct. Yeah?
One of the, I don't know if it's unfortunately, but one of the halakhic poskim who say that transgender is equivalent to the Gemara's tumtum.
Well, okay, well, we have to be careful here. In other words, like this. Maybe I'm using transgender in the wrong way. I was referring now to a case where somebody was born definitively one gender or the other, and they want to change them. That is not the tumtum. The tumtum is someone that is born with ambiguous genitalia, and either hermaphrodite or whatever.
Wouldn't that be androgynous, though?
An androgynous or hermaphrodite or a micro, you know, they're different. In other words, the gender is not clearly assigned. Now there, that's a separate body of halacha. Some will permit a gender assignment when there's hermaphrodite. But a person that's born definitively male who just wants to be a female, even if there are hormonal reasons, would not be a tumtum. Would not be a tumtum because tumtum refers to ambiguous genitalia. It does not refer to sexual preference. There are many people who may have a sexual preference to be one thing or the other.
Transgenderism has nothing to do with sexuality.
Well, all I can say is that tumtum requires externalities. It does not refer to internal struggles, whether they be of a physiological or a psychological nature. So if someone externally has the genitalia of a male and does not have those of a female, then their initial definition is that of a male, and then they are trying to change that.
Then why would some poskim equate transgenderism?
I'm not familiar with some poskim. You have to tell me. I am actually not familiar with any reputable posek that treats it as a tumtum.
How can the Jewish community better deal with like issues that they like seemingly don't seem to be addressed so much, like with like physical abuse or like sexual abuse or things like that?
Well, like anything else, you know, unpleasant issues we tend to sweep under the rug. But I have to say, and Baruch Hashem, I want to point out that although bloggers love to uncover every incident within the Frum community to show that we're all abusers and we're all sexual addicts and everything else, I mean, Baruch Hashem, in the religious community, things are much, much less than there are in other communities. But they do exist. They do exist. And there are people that are victimized and people whose lives are destroyed. And people were ashamed or embarrassed to talk about it, and people were afraid, I won't get a shidduch for my children if I bring out these stories. But I think if you look around, you'll see there is more awareness. People are talking about it. People are addressing it. And Baruch Hashem, people are working to eradicate the evils that are going on. So all I can tell you is that things are coming out in a way that hopefully will be positive and constructive. Okay, maybe one more question, then we'll... Okay, all right.
Is there any issue of going to one of these, a lot of going to these non-denominational weddings? So it's not in the church, there's like your local affiliate spiritual leader who marries them off.
Is it a spiritual ceremony or a civil ceremony? No, I'm saying if two Gaisha friends are going to a justice of the peace, you're allowed to go and give them good wishes. Now, if they're having a non-denominational religious ceremony, that's a little tricky. It kind of depends. You know, you don't know ahead of time what's going to go on. You know, if they simply say, may God bless this marriage, the creator of heaven and earth, that's fine also, because that could be like Noahide marriage. But if they talk about, the chakras and the Hindus and all of that business, then you have to be careful. So you simply don't know what's coming down the pike, you know.
So don't go.
I would say it's better not to go. I think you might be hit with all sorts of religious ideas that you're not allowed to be connected to. Okay, have a good day.